It's the NPR News Update podcast for Wednesday, April 1st. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News. Included within, more layoffs ahead for the Iron Range. A Minnesota professor is in hot water over trade in elephant ivory and rhino horns. Minnesota firefighters train for oil train explosions. Environmentalists fear what they see as attempts to weaken state regulations. And a newly arrived Minnesotan has an award-winning idea to make Minnesota nice even nicer. First, more mining layoffs are coming to the Iron Range. U.S. Steel has announced it will idle part of the Minntac plant in Mountain Iron in June, affecting nearly 700 workers. That comes a few weeks after 400 workers at another U.S. steel plant, Keetac, learned that they will be laid off in May. The company blames the layoffs on high inventory levels amid a worldwide steel glut. Elizabeth Dunbar reports state leaders fear this could be the beginning.
An increasing supply of iron ore globally doesn't automatically hurt U.S. production, as long as there's strong global demand for steel. And right now, there is not.
Chinese state-owned steel companies are producing way more than the Chinese economy needs. Therefore, they have to export it.
Tony Barrett is an economics professor at the College of St. Scholastica in Duluth.
They look to the one economy in the world that's doing reasonably well, which is ours, and they sell it in the United States. And that you can replicate that story with Korea or with India or with any other country that produces steel. We are sort of the market of last resort.
Barrett says steel being imported into the United States can be perfectly legitimate. But if the foreign companies selling it here are doing so at a loss, that's known as illegal dumping. That's what Minnesota's Iron Range lawmakers, some of the state's congressional delegation, and Governor Mark Dayton have said is happening. DFL Senator Al Franken traveled to the Iron Range to meet with Minntac workers.
Well, this is an enormous deal for the range, and this is getting scary now because these 700 jobs are on top of 400 jobs. And we ship this taconite out of the port of Duluth. This is extremely important to our entire state economy.
Franken says his impression after a recent meeting with U.S. trade officials was that they are taking the issue seriously. But DFL Representative Jason Metza, who represents the area that includes the Minntac plant, says the Obama administration and Congress are not doing enough to enforce trade agreements aimed at protecting U.S. interests.
It's time the lawmakers out there go and fix the agreements so they work. If not, get the heck out of them. We shouldn't be reliant on foreign countries to provide us steel. We produced the taconite up here that built the ships that enabled the greatest generation to win World War II. And it would be a damn shame if we forget all that and say, we can do it in someone else's backyard.
It's a tough political issue because while U.S. steelworkers are losing their jobs, some U.S. companies are saving a lot of money because steel prices hit a 10-year low this week. On Minnesota's Iron Range, local leaders are bracing for even more layoffs. Virginia Mayor Larry Cuffey Jr. says he can only hope the plants won't be idled too long.
And now they have to find another job, and of course, the majority of the jobs here are either in the mines or they're mining support industries, and there's not a lot of diverse economy in our community, so that makes it devastating. So people either have to move away or hope that, you know, the economy recovers to the point where they can get their, you know, return to their work.
For now, U.S. Steel says it will keep part of Minntac running, sparing about 800 workers from layoffs. But observers say they don't expect a rapid turnaround for the industry. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
As we heard, Iron Range layoffs are blamed on low prices for steel. U.S. industry officials point fingers at what they say are illegal trade practices. Are they? Tony Barrett is a professor of economics at the College of St. Scholastica. He talked with Kathy Werzer.
I've often heard the phrase illegal dumping. Now, what does that term mean?
Dumping is a frowned upon international trade practice. It's not technically prohibited, but it's frowned upon. It's considered bad form. It's a two-step process. A company like U.S. Steel would have to go to court at the Department of Commerce and the International Trade Commission and claim that they have been materially harmed by illegal dumped steel. Technically, dumping means the exporting country, let's say
Chinese steel company, hypothetically, is selling the steel in the United States for less than the cost of production. And while that's hard to determine, the rule of thumb generally is the Chinese steel company selling the steel for less in the United States than they do at home?
Is this what's happening at this point?
I can't say that with 100% certainty, but how about 99% certainty? Yes.
So the penalties are not imposed on foreign companies until domestic companies can prove they've been hurt, which is, seems like it's tough to do.
Well, it's time-consuming to do, but it should be. I mean, we just have over 1,000 layoffs in the United States here. I mean, and not just in the taconite mines. I know U.S. Steel is closing some of their mills. So I think proving it will eventually be rather straightforward. It's just that it's time-consuming.
Why would foreign companies want to set prices so low, less than the cost of production? Don't they have incentives for profits as well?
No. That's the difference. If you have a state-owned steel company in China, their priorities are more staying in operation, keeping employment high, keeping their workers happy, and they don't need to make the profit that a U.S. steel company would have to. We can't do it in this country because we have stockholders who wouldn't tolerate it. But in other countries, and not just China, steel companies are frequently owned by the government, and profit's not their number one priority.
Do you see any good coming out of low iron prices? Some industries, I would think, would appreciate it, like the auto industry.
Exactly. That's the political tension that's going on in Washington. While our senators and congressmen can go to the White House and Department of Commerce and ask for help, you can be sure that the congressmen and senators from states that are big steel consumers, like Detroit, Michigan, are saying, hey, this is great. We love the cheap steel. That's the political tension.
Mm. So some lawmakers, as you know, are talking about maybe modifying these agreements. Do you see that happening and any good coming from that?
In the long run, I think that's a good idea. I mean, this whole process is so slow. I mean, up here, we can look around and see that there's something wrong going on. Steel imports are surging at an abnormally high level. We're seeing layoffs, so we have the material harm. We have the low prices. It seems to me there should be a quicker way to resolve this, but that's down the road. That's for the next cycle.
Professor Barrett, thanks for the conversation.
My pleasure.
Professor Barrett and Werzer on Morning Edition. A St. Cloud State philosophy professor is facing federal charges related to smuggling elephant ivory and rhino horn. The man says his business is legitimate, but wildlife officials say they're worried about the trade that violates international law. Peter Cox has more.
Yuing Zhang has taught philosophy at St. Cloud State University since 1999. But federal authorities believe from 2006 to 2011, he was also illegally smuggling and shipping elephant ivory and rhino horn between China and the United States. He was arrested yesterday morning outside of a Panera Bread in St. Cloud. In the afternoon, he made his initial appearance in U.S. District Court in St. Paul on 6 counts, including conspiracy, smuggling, and violating the Lacey Act, which prohibits the trade of illegally taken or sold wildlife. Zhang has not yet entered a plea. Pat Lund is a resident agent with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
We've had a number of wildlife smuggling cases over the years, both with wildlife being imported illegally and exported illegally. We haven't had many that involve just rhino horn and elephant tusks like this one had. Unfortunately, those kind of cases are becoming less and less rare.
The indictment says Zhang, with the help of two co-conspirators in China, shipped items between the U.S. and China, sometimes through the U.S. mail. On occasion, he allegedly found buyers online for items that federal agents suspect were made of ivory. They say he did many of these transactions through his business in St. Cloud called Crouching Dragon Antiques. The indictment says he mostly dealt in decorative or carved pieces, but he's also accused of sending two rhino horns from the U.S. to China. Lund says prosecutions of similar cases in the U.S. have been on the rise.
A large part of that is because of the demand in Southeast Asia and China in particular. Recent affluence in that part of the world has created sort of a demand for things that are seen as status symbols. Sometimes the rhino horn is looked at as having medicinal value.
The World Wildlife Fund says more than 12,000 elephants are poached each year, mostly in Central Africa. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature classifies African elephants as a vulnerable species and lists black rhinoceros as critically endangered. An international treaty signed by the U.S. in 1976 banned most trade in both rhino horn and elephant ivory. Some antique ivory pieces are allowed to be traded internationally or sold, but only with certification. A warrant says neither Zhang nor his business had permits or licenses to import or export such items. Zhang was released on $25,000 bond. He surrendered his passport and isn't allowed to leave the state without court permission. Adam Hammer, a spokesman for St. Cloud State University, says Zhang has not been fired because of the pending case.
Mr. Zhang remains an employee at St. Cloud State University, and like all employee matters, there is a process for determining if actions affecting employment are necessary. The university is prepared to make sure students' needs are met and that his classes will be covered.
Hammer says it is possible Zhang could continue to teach while his case goes through the court process. Reporters swarmed after Zhang when he left the courthouse, asking him questions as he fed dollars into the machine at a parking ramp.
Is your business a legitimate business, sir?
Yes.
Do you expect to fight these charges?
Yes.
I would imagine this comes as a bit of a shock then.
Yes, the life is full of surprises.
Officials with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the U.S. Attorney's Office declined to comment if more arrests are planned. Peter Cox, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Fears of exploding oil trains are behind new firefighter training initiatives in Minnesota and across the country. But the benefits of the training go beyond crude oil fires by preparing firefighters for even more dangerous hazards. Dan Gunderson reports.
When a train filled with Bakken crude derailed and exploded near Castleton, North Dakota 15 months ago, all firefighters could do was watch.
We were maybe a little bit more than a quarter mile away, and when each fireball went up, we could feel the heat like 2 seconds later. It just kind of just lofted that way and hit you right in the face.
That experience puts Castleton Fire Chief Tim McLean in a select group of firefighters who have firsthand experience with exploding crude oil tank cars. Since the accident, 8 Castleton firefighters, including Chief McLean, have attended a rail industry-sponsored oil train safety program in Pueblo, Colorado.
That was very helpful. I know when I went, we were the only department there that was volunteer. Everybody else was full-time, and they helped us, and we told them about our experience. So,
given the things you've learned, if that incident happened again here, would you do anything different?
No, I don't believe we would.
That's because federal guidelines say if an oil tank car is burning, firefighters should take a defensive position and evacuate people within a half mile of the accident. New funding is helping Morehead firefighters expand their hazardous materials training. Last year, Morehead joined St. Paul as the state's 2 designated emergency response teams.
So we want to go into the predefined cases.
A half dozen Morehead firefighters are hunched over monitor screens in a dark room as they learn new computer software. The program allows first responders to map a chemical release and predict where the chemical cloud will go. Fire Captain Ryan Muckow says Morehead is the first department in the state to have the plume modeling software, which costs $1,000 a month. He says it's a very important tool.
You know, if we map it out and it says within 30 minutes we should be getting the product, say, 2 miles downwind, that's where we can make our decision. Can we get people out of there before the product gets to them?
Ironically, the software doesn't model a crude oil fire. The software company is developing that model to add to the program. Muckow says while oil trains are the hot topic right now, first responders know they must be prepared for even more dangerous chemicals.
The acute effects of a chemical release like chlorine or anhydrous is a significant concern, and that's where, you know, sheltering people in place sometimes is the best thing because, you know, a couple breaths in a true cloud could be enough to cause significant health risks, you know, if not death, immediately.
A variety of hazardous materials are included in the Minnesota Department of Public Safety awareness training sessions mandated by the 2014 legislature. About 1,800 Minnesota first responders have attended classes so far. Director of Homeland Security and Operations Kevin Reed says it will take about 2 more years to train more than 300 fire departments.
But we are also looking at, once we get the awareness done, what is the next level of training? What can we bring to the fire departments, police departments, emergency medical service people, the emergency managers. What's that next level?
Reed says the next level is likely to include classroom exercises in communities across the state and eventually full-scale exercises. But planning for a full-scale exercise takes about 18 months. Reed hopes one or two can be developed in the next 2 years. Educating Minnesota residents will also be part of future efforts. Right now, firefighters and other first responders are the focus of training. But Morehead Fire Captain Ryan Muckow says it's also critical that residents are prepared.
Are you ready if you got the phone call saying you need to evacuate? Are you prepared? Are you prepared, or do you know what it takes to shelter in place?
The State Department of Public Safety is encouraging local communities to develop programs that help residents answer those questions. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Morehead.
Months after rural voters helped Republicans reclaim the majority in the Minnesota House, lawmakers in both parties are looking to weaken environmental laws that apply to agriculture. Legislation helping the ag industry is moving through the House and the Senate. And as Tom Scheck reports, environmental groups appear unable to stop it.
Governor Dayton is scheduled to hit the road this week to push for his plan that would require farmers to leave a 50-foot buffer zone unplanted around rivers, streams, and ditches. Dayton said the proposal will reduce pesticide and fertilizer runoff that's harming the environment. He pointed to a recent study by the Pollution Control Agency that found that no lakes and only a few streams in southwestern Minnesota meet the state's quality standards for fishing and swimming.
Legislators down in the southwestern corner, which is the prime area for this study, where the rivers and streams are being fouled by all this waste and excess that's pouring into them, and the legislators there want to just, you know, keep their heads buried in the sand and do nothing about it. I mean, at some point you got to say, well, are you here to protect the public, or are you here to protect, you know, a few other folks?
Dayton is facing stiff resistance from agriculture lobbying groups. The pushback from farmers has stalled his bill. DFL Senator Dan Sparks of Austin says Dayton's buffer bill can't get through the Senate Jobs, Agriculture, and Rural Development Committee. Sparks chairs the committee and says Dayton's current plan is unworkable.
Obviously, we're all for clean water, but at the same time, I think we need to make sure that agriculture has a seat at the table and is willing to be a part of the final solution.
The buffer bill isn't the only one where ag interests are flexing their muscles. Others include measures that exempt farmland from some school levies and some that touch on pesticide regulation. Republican Senator Gary Dames of Redwood Falls is pushing language that removes the definition of a pollinator lethal insecticide from state statute. Those include the neonicotinoid class of insecticides that some researchers have linked to the deaths of bees and other pollinators. Dames's move had the backing of the pesticide industry. He said he was worried the definition of the insecticide was loosely drawn.
The terms and the facts just aren't there. We don't have any limits. We don't know. We don't describe what a lethal plant is. We don't have any targets, and it's very vague. So that's why I'm asking for this to be repealed.
Another bill moving through the Republican-controlled House would make it tougher for homeowners to file nuisance lawsuits against livestock producers. Bron Scher, with a hog farm management company, Protein Sources Management, said recently the bill is needed to protect Minnesota's farming community.
Without animal agriculture in this state, I shudder to think what rural Minnesota would be like. And once it's gone, it does not come back.
Scherer is also the treasurer of the Minnesota Republican Party. Officials representing ag interests downplayed any suggestion they're trying to use newfound political clout to roll over opponents, especially urban environmentalists. Kevin Papp, president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau, said he has members all across Minnesota.
We are not, from a Farm Bureau perspective, if I can do anything about it as the president, are going to get into this rural versus urban. You know, we have one thing in common, and that is everybody eats. Food is agriculture, and we want to make sure everyone is at the table.
But DFL Representative Rick Hansen of South St. Paul says groups representing agriculture and other rural interests are looking for a payback for showing up at the polls last November.
The money is the pollution in the system here at the Minnesota Legislature, and it's getting worse.
Hansen worries the state's environmental laws will be weakened as legislators from both parties compete for the support of rural business interests.
To interpret election results as a rollback, as a green light for a rollback in environmental protection, is a mistake. And, you know, we'll see all this action, and if it goes on and nobody says a peep, then I think we will see more environmental rollbacks.
And even as Governor Dayton pushes for cleaner water through buffer zones, some environmental groups have criticized him for supporting what they say are lower pollution standards for waters where wild rice grows. Tom Scheck, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Well, how do you make a city more successful? The Knight Foundation asked people across the U.S. to suggest ideas, and they've announced 32 winning projects in the first ever Knight Cities Challenge. Two of those projects were submitted by a St. Paul woman who thinks the key to making her adopted city more successful is by making it more welcoming to outsiders. Jun Lee Wong is an artist community organizer with the Springboard for the Arts. She talked with Tom Cran last night.
Tell me about your experience coming to St. Paul. Where else have you lived, and what was that like?
Sure. I'm from Berkeley, California, but then after college on the East Coast, I lived in China for about 5 years.
And then you moved to St. Paul when?
I moved to St. Paul in 2002 without a job, but with a husband who had a job here.
And what was that experience like for you?
It was really tough. We did not know very many people, and I tried to just network, generally network, because I didn't have to get a job right away. And it was, you know, I would meet people, and they would be friendly, but they wouldn't say, hey, come do this with us, or you should talk to these people. There was really just none of that.
And that differed from, for example, Shanghai, a city of, what, 20 million people, right? One of the biggest cities on the planet.
Right.
What was it like there?
Well, I would move to a new city and maybe have one contact or have a job. And immediately within literally 24 hours, I would be part of a network and people would call me to go do things with them. It was very different.
So it sounds like you think it's different here than in other places in your experience.
Absolutely.
In that regard.
Absolutely. And I've heard from a lot of other people who've moved to Minnesota or who've left after a time that they had difficulties breaking in.
Now, these grants are meant to make cities more successful. So tell us, in your mind, how does this welcoming piece actually make the city more successful?
Right. Well, we want people to come here and we want them to stay. We want them to find jobs, to keep their jobs, and we want them to, you know, find the things that they want to do on the weekend, et cetera. So by welcoming them, then we can create the right environment for them.
Now, let's go through your ideas. There are two of them which won some grants. One of them, I understand, has to do with mixers, basically events for people, and I'm assuming for new people and the people who are already established here.
Yes.
Is that the way you see it?
Yes. So
what
Minnesota
would they be like?
Yeah. So Minnesota Nicebreakers, working off the backs of existing event organizers and activity providers and adding into the mix an ambassador who facilitates or who gets people really talking to one another. So you might go on a walking tour, but in addition to learning about nature or that particular stretch of avenue, you would be encouraged to talk to the other people on the tour and even exchange contact information.
Okay. And then the other one, I understand, has to do with hats, warm hats. And tell me how that idea came about.
Right. Well, last winter during the polar vortex debacle, I happened to buy one of the Elmer Fudd sort of faux fur-lined hats. And I discovered that that was the trick to surviving winter.
A good hat.
Fake fur-lined hat with ear flaps. Not just a good hat.
Yeah. The one with the ear flaps, the classic.
The
plaid?
Classic.
Is it in plaid?
Doesn't have to be plaid.
Okay.
Mine is black.
Yeah.
But it has to have the fake fur or real fur lining.
What will the success of this project, these projects, because you have two of them, look like, actually?
So for me, success will be, so super long-term is culture shift. 10, 20 years out from now is a culture where we don't need these things anymore because so many Minnesotans are accustomed to asking deeper questions and reaching out a little more.
Okay. But a couple of years down the line?
Sure. Short term, I hope that we don't have to grant fund this, that activity providers or companies think that this is worth doing and that we can keep them going that way.
And other than the fact that this was your experience and you know people, I think we all do know people and have our own experiences when we moved here. Other than the fact that it was based on your experience, why is this important for St. Paul to do?
Well, I think there's statistics that show young people, young professionals move here for work and then they leave because they can't find community. And that was my experience, although I didn't move, obviously. And I think we, you know, when we think about the new immigrants who come here, people who maybe don't have jobs, I mean, I think we want them to stay because the more people we have here, the more diverse type of people, the more diversity we have, the stronger we'll be.
Jun Lee Wong, congratulations on the grants and thanks for coming in to talk with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Jun Lee Wong and Tom Cran on All Things Considered. I'm Phil Picardi, and that's the Wednesday podcast. I'll be here tomorrow with the Thursday NPR News Update.